Welcome everybody to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we explain how everything has a history, even the most unexpected of subjects, like puzzles, bowls, and backwardness.
I love the idea of doing backwardness. We should do a podcast from reverse. We should, you know, it'll be brilliant. I'm just trying to compute that at the moment. However, for the moment, we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example? Who knew, Sam? Did you know this? That the history of bells is, in fact, all about the Reformation? Or that the history of beads, yes, beads, is, in fact, all about trade and exchange in the Viking world? A very serious topic indeed.
The man not sitting opposite me because we're social distancing, he will help pilot us through these micro histories. He's one of the country's leading professors of history. It's Professor Extraordinaire James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. Lovely to see you on Zoom, actually. We haven't seen each other for a while. But the man who I'm spying on Zoom, who's not sitting opposite me because we are in this time of lockdown, but ably helping me co-pilot these episodes, he is the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. This is the fifth, we've done five, hooray,
five
of our special Christmas-themed micro-histories in which we embrace the task of demonstrating how an unexpected subject not only has a history, but is massively important and interesting in just 15 minutes, and we do it without just talking faster. We start with a shared example and then have just 5 minutes each to make a case for an interesting history on that very unexpected subject. Contributions are rigorously timed.
And you, our dear listeners, you will get to vote on social media on what you think was the most interesting fact that you heard in the episode.
And today's topic, inspired by Christmas, is, believe it or not, the history of spite. James, where are we going to start?
Ah, spite, rather like evil. Nothing quite says Christmas like spite. Now, you're probably all busily writing Christmas cards, licking the envelopes, or you're in the middle of doing this. I sent mine super early this year. I wrote them in mid-November and then put them on a shelf and didn't post them until the 1st of December because I basically thought people would think I was a bit weird. Well, it is a bit weird. However, if you are doing this, just take note of the following, because the custom of exchanging greeting cards during the festive season was a Victorian invention, with the first commercial card produced by Sir Henry Cole in, get this, 1843. From the 1870s onwards, the introduction of the halfpenny stamp made postage much more affordable. And of course, everyone could start sending cards, which boosted the popularity of sending Christmas cards for ordinary Victorian people. And many examples of 19th century Christmas cards survive in collections of Victorian scrapbooks, which you can find in libraries around the country. Just Google Victorian scrapbooks and Christmas cards, and you will come up with all sorts of delights.
Among the cheerful Yuletide messages you might see there, many of which actually were distinctly secular, a number take on quite a surprising, sinister, almost a spiteful note, which is why we've come to it. Examples include an image of a dead robin, just rolled over and dead, a child boiled in a teapot, a clown sneaking up on a policeman to assault him, grisly-looking snowmen, and, of course, nothing quite says Merry Christmas like the depiction of a frog murder. So in one of these cards, this isn't a joke, by the way, it's a frog, right, murdering a fellow frog with a dagger to the soft underbelly and then running off with the dead frog's money. And what's the message? Well, it's may you have a Merry Christmas. Unlike this unfortunate amphibian. Brilliant stuff.
You'll be very glad to know that I sent nobody a dead frog card this year. However, I did send robins. And as we know from one of our previous podcasts, sending robin Christmas cards is in fact quite unlucky.
It is a bad luck one.
I'm very, very sorry. It was an RSPB card, so I was supporting charity, but I'm immensely sorry about that. Now, where are we going to go with this? Do you want to start, Sam, or shall I start?
You go, James, you go. Let's take us somewhere on the extraordinary history of spite. You have 5 minutes. Begin now.
Okay, well, I'm going to go in a very similar direction, postally, because I, as somebody who has worked for his entire academic career on letters, notwithstanding recent forays into gloves, I've been very interested in letters and poison pen letters, in particular spiteful pen letters. And there are two ways of thinking about this. There are poison pen letters, which are simply abusive and malicious, that you're sending somebody, you know, anonymous venom in the mail. And I have been the recipient of such a letter in my time. Or they are quite literally poisoned. And there is a practice across time of sending poison in the post, literally poison in the post. And one of the most recent examples of this happened in September 2020, and it was a letter sent to the current president of the United States, Donald Trump, which contained the poison ricin. And they found out who did it, and we actually have a copy of the letter, which if you Google it, it got into the newspapers, it got onto social media. And I just want to read it. "I found a new name for you. The ugly tyrant clown. I hope you like it. You ruin USA and lead them to disaster. I have US cousins. Then I don't want the next 4 years with you as president. Give up and remove your application for this election. So I made a special gift for you to help you make a decision. This gift is in the letter. If it doesn't work, I'll find a better recipe for another poison. Or I might use my gun when I'll be able to come. Enjoy." And signed, Free Rebel Spirit. It's extraordinary that somebody would want to, you know, send a letter like that, and so maliciously. Whatever you think of people's politics, absolutely obnoxious. But there's an incredible history of this. You know, that we can trace back to the early 20th century, you know, in the sort of time of, you know, the First World War. And you think about the sort of horrors of warfare, the kind of toxic gas that is used at the time, the poison sort of phosgene and mustard gases that you see. But that's not the only poison that is peddled at that time, because people were also writing really poisonous letters to each other. And there's one particular example that I want to talk about, which is connected to the American state of New Jersey and the city of Elizabeth, which is near New York City itself. And there in 1909, there's a scandal of somebody who is supposed to be possessed of, and I quote, a serpent typewriter, and sent letters of hate to public figures, accusing women of clandestinely prostituting themselves to men in New York. And she writes to one woman that she keeps one or two roomers and does a little dressmaking to hide her double life. Look at her clothes of elegance, yet her husband is a baggage checker on the Pennsylvania Railroad in winter and purser on the Hudson River ferry boat in the summer. Never saw $80 a month in his life, yet they keep a maid and she is on the go all the time. Once a week she meets an Elizabeth man over on Staten Island, and once a week she meets a New York man in New York City. And in that way she makes $40 a month. She will do nothing but honest work for money. And so it's awful that you would write those sort of public poisonous letters trying to, you know, disparage your neighbours and people within the community. And there are various sort of other people who she writes this, and she ends up being caught. So they find out who this person is that's doing it. It's one Mrs. Pollard who goes to trial. And she is somebody who, she turns up, she's swathed in a veil so that you can't really see her. She has with her the minister of an Episcopal church sitting beside her. And they are, the trial itself is so cross and angry.
That's it. Your time is up, James. The Astronomical Clock of Prague has interrupted you, which was made in 1410. Very ancient clock there. And it's got one of these kind of little mechanised people, and they all look quite unpleasant and spiteful.
So the bit that I wasn't going to say, that's a fantastic sound, but the bit that I was, that I didn't have chance to say, but that I will fill you in on very briefly, if I may, in a sentence plus, is that during this examination, they bring out a handwriting expert, a really famous handwriting expert from the period, William Kinsley. And he's also an expert on typewriters, and he manages to match the type on the letters with this woman's typewriter. And because there are imperfections on particular letters that are used, they are identical in all of the documents, and she is caught. So her comeuppance. So I suppose, you know, Christmas, in this sense, spite is all about sending people poison and venom through the mail. Poison pen letters. OK, Sam, where are you going to go with this? Because you have simply 5 minutes. And as usual, I am going to reset my stopwatch and I am going to time you rigorously. On your marks, get set, go!
Girl, I am going to take us to the summer of 1888. It feels a bit wintry, so I thought I'd do some summer stuff. Going to Victorian London. Then it was a divided city, very different from now, although there's still very much a West End and an East End. West End was home to wealthier Londoners. The East End was crowded. There was slum housing everywhere. And I'm going to be talking to you about Jack the Ripper. It's about time we actually came up with Jack. We haven't talked about him before on the podcast. And he operated in the East End in what was known at the time as the Evil Square Mile. It includes the districts of Whitechapel, Spitalfields, Aldgate, all quite nice places nowadays. But at the time, think narrow streets, think darkness, think passages, alleyways and crime. So his first victim on the 30th of August was Mary Ann Nichols, known as Polly. She was found dead. Her throat had been cut and her body was being partially disemboweled. 8 days later, he strikes again. Annie Chapman, this time in the backyard of a building in Spitalfields. She, like Polly, had also had her throat cut and she'd been partially disemboweled. This is when it becomes interesting in terms of letters, James, because I'm actually going to be talking about spiteful letters just like you. So nearly a month after Polly's death, the first lady to die, a letter arrives at the central news agency claiming to be the killer. And this author taunts the police about an early theory of theirs that the murder was by someone called the Leather Apron. And he ends by taunting that there, again, would be more mutilations. Then there are two more deaths and one more letter. First of those deaths to be discovered was a lady known as Long Liz, but her full name was Elizabeth Stride. And just a matter of minutes later, less than an hour later, a second body was discovered nearby, and that was the body of Catherine Eddowes. This causes there to be more letters appear. Another one here from who the police actually do believe to be the killer. And it says, "I was not kidding, dear old boss, when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about saucy Jackie work tomorrow. Double event this time. Number one squealed a bit, but couldn't finish straight off. Had not time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Signed, Jack the Ripper." What the police do is that they believe that these first two letters are authentic. They're actually written by the serial killer. And they decide to publish them in the hope that someone might come forward being able to identify the handwriting. Similar theme to what you were talking, James, about identifying the penmanship or the typewriters. Anyway, to this end, these letters were printed. But what happens is that it creates a huge stream of letters from would-be Jack the Rippers, which contain very unpleasant, crude messages stating an intention to murder again. They're very spiteful letters, which is why I've got to focus on them today. They're designed specifically to annoy the people looking for Jack. They're designed to annoy the police. They're designed to offend the public, and all for no gain, just being anonymous. So I thought I'd read you out some of these spiteful letters from the summer of 1888 around the hunt for Jack the Ripper. "Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I've laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I'm down on whores and won't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last one was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little game. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. Ha ha. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly. Wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work and give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck, Jack the Ripper. And then another one. September 1888. Dear sir, I do wish to give myself up. I'm in misery with nightmare. I am the man who committed all these murders in the last 6 months. My name is Drawing of a Coffin. So and so, I'm a horse slaughterer and work at somewhere, blocked out address. I've found the woman I want, that is Chapman, and I've done what I called slaughtered her, but if anyone comes, I will surrender. I'm not going to walk to the station by myself, so I am yours truly, silhouette of a coffin. Keep the Borough Road clear, or I might make a trip up there, photograph, little picture of a knife. This is the knife that I've done these murders with. It is small handle with a... I'm stopping.
The house, not a creature was stirring. Not even a mouse.
Ah, that was a little extract from Clement C. Moore's 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, read by one of my favourite people in the entire world, Stephen Fry.
Oh, and it also sounds a bit creepy. The whole nothing was stirring, not even a mouse. There we go. Let me finish my sentence. This is the knife I done these murders with. It is small handle with large, long blade, sharp both sides. So there you have it, James. Spite, in this sense, it's all about malicious, hurtful, taunting letters sent to the police in the aftermath of the Jack the Ripper murders in the summer of 1888 in the delightful capital of England. Aren't we all a lovely bunch here?
Oh, really. Happy Christmas, stuff. Everyone.
Happy Christmas. I hope you enjoyed that on Spite. Do please follow us on social media for some more. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis.
And I'm at James Daybell. And the pod is at Unexpected Pod. You can find out everything that we have been doing, everything we've been up to, everything that we are going to be doing on our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com.
Where you can buy some signed books for Christmas. There's still time. You can sneak one into the stockings of your loved ones. We've got little series books on the Romans, the Tudors, World War II, and the Vikings, I do believe, James, as well as our bigger books. So do please check that out, and we'll be back with you guys soon. Cheerio.
Bye, guys.